I have a country right now. I don't have any problem here.
I just felt it's just out of the system. An outsider. I don't know how to explain it better. It's just I felt an outsider.
This is a special episode of KUNC's Colorado Edition, devoted to sharing stories and voices from our series on the state's refugee communities. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Brian Larson.
Refugees have a big impact on the economy of the states they settle in. Some start businesses in their communities. Others find work in the hospitality industry, on farms, or in the case of northern Colorado, meatpacking plants. And those industries take a hit when fewer refugees settle here.
For those who do come, it can be challenging to adjust. That is especially true for doctors, nurses, or other medical professionals who arrive in Colorado only to find their foreign certifications are not worth much.
That is who I am. That's how much I have invested time, money, many years of my life to get to that point. And it's not a new dream, it's just getting back to who I am.
We'll hear what it's like for these highly skilled professionals to start over in a new country and what Colorado is doing to help.
And for younger people, there's the challenge of school. Now, high school can be tough for anyone, but for newcomer students who need to overcome language and cultural barriers, there are extra challenges.
I was really nervous. Like, I'm a first time. Nobody knows me, who I am, and where I come from.
We'll meet three students from the same family who are making the transition together. But first, we start with this question. Where do these refugees come from? For the answer, KUNC's Catherine Welch spoke with Colin Cannon. He's with the Immigration and Refugee Center of Northern Colorado.
People who are primarily arriving are coming from three countries primarily. One is the Democratic Republic of Congo. The second is the Republic of Myanmar, also known as Burma. We have Eritrea as the third largest country. Now, when it comes to secondary arrivals, which means that the individuals are already resettled into the United States but then are choosing Colorado after they've already been here, then we also add Somalia to that mix. We have a large population of Somali individuals coming to Colorado. And the reason they're coming here, both as primary and secondary arrivals, is for a variety of reasons. One, it's the relatively low cost of living, which is, of course, is changing. Secondly, it's the ubiquity of jobs in agriculture and meatpacking that draws them here with the promise of a decent enough wage and kind of no questions asked about English ability or anything else. Thirdly, they have community members already here whom they can network with.
So Greeley, Fort Morgan, and Aurora have some of the largest refugee populations. I would imagine language has got to be a barrier. How do they get help with translations? How do they communicate?
Language barriers are usually overcome through a variety of ways. First and foremost, it's a social network, including children. So I'll give an anecdotal story about this. I won't say which high school, but there's a local high school that has a group of young men who are not excelling in their academics. And when we approached them as an organization saying, hey, how can we raise your academic performance? They said, well, I need to be in class more. The reason I'm out of class is because I need to help my family and friends in setting appointments, in going to the bank, in doing routine daily life exercises, which because my English ability is so much greater than theirs, they asked me to join them, which of course is admirable and understandable. At the same time, we could see the academic cost to those children.
Have city governments realized they need to communicate in various languages to reach these diverse communities?
One of the ways that I've really seen evidence of cities, I'll talk specifically about Greeley, really taking the diversity of their communities and the diversity of languages to the fore is in preparation for the census, which is coming up in 2020. They have been adamant about having representation at those tables to say not only does it matter that you are able to take this census so that you are counted, but it matters that you have input in the process of how we're going to market it to communities, making sure that we break the language barriers to get people informed about what the census means and why their representation matters. And so I've been blown away in a very positive way about just how proactive Greeley has been in making sure that the diversity of the community that lives here as it is represented.
A state report found refugees are putting more back into the economy than they get in assistance. So what's the impact on a place like Fort Morgan if there are fewer refugees settling there?
So the economic impact is actually pretty great. And so this is something that I've never really understood. It seems that even the staunchest capitalist should be the most ardent supporter of refugee resettlement, particularly because we return on this investment in two ways. One, in tax revenue at the local and state level. The return on that, as the state study showed, was actually over a dollar. It was $1.23 in tax revenue brought back. But then in economic activity, it was $1.68 in actual economic activity. So cities like Greeley and Fort Morgan, where we have large industries in meatpacking, in agriculture, growing in hospitality services as it relates to hotels, these industries are growing and they need a labor force that's willing to take those jobs. This has been one of the lasting great debates as it relates to immigration as a whole in terms of who do we choose in order to work these jobs, and will a native-born workforce ultimately end up choosing these? And there's mixed results on this. What we see is that our refugee cohort are willing and able to take these jobs, which pay well enough. They're a job that the individuals are more than capable of doing, and they use as a platform to raise their economic mobility.
Colin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Colin Cannon is the Director of Advocacy and Development for the Immigrant and Refugee Center of Northern Colorado.
Greeley is home to the second largest refugee community in the state. That's in large part because of low-skilled yet high-paying jobs at meatpacking plant JBS. It's tough work, and it can take a toll on those who are employed there. But for refugees looking to start a new life in Colorado, there aren't a lot of other options. KUNC's Esther Honing has more on the workers who help feed America.
The JBS plant in Greeley is so massive, it can process thousands of cattle a day. More than 3,000 people work there, and many are refugees, like Abul Basar.
Hello. How are you?
I met Basar at his apartment, along with his wife and two young children. He tells me he was violently persecuted in his former country of Burma, also known as Myanmar. He fled and spent 5 years moving from country to country.
Very difficult times. I don't have work over there, just eating, sleeping. That's it.
He was finally relocated to Greeley in 2017, and his case manager helped him apply for a job at JBS.
It's a very hard job. It's a very difficult job. JBS, very difficult. It's not easy.
But it's one of the few jobs that requires little to no English and pays a starting wage of about $15 an hour. That's why, according to the Fiscal Policy Institute, meatpacking has the fifth highest concentration of refugee workers behind taxi and truck drivers. JBS wouldn't comment on refugees and their workforce, so we reached out to Eric Mittenthal.
Refugees have been very good employees and are very good employees within the industry.
Mittenthal is with the North American Meat Institute, which represents the industry. He insists companies like JBS aren't concerned about a Trump administration policy limiting the number of refugees coming to the U.S. They only care about finding enough workers, regardless of where they come from.
When labor market's tight, it's tough to get folks, and so they're interested in any measures to ensure that people are available to do the work.
Which can be difficult in an industry where worker turnover is high and the rate of illness and injury is 2.5 times the national average.
Show me what it is that happens.
Abul Basar spent more than a year working on the fast-paced production line, where he used a large electric knife to disembowel cow carcasses. After a few months, his hands began to hurt.
It gets stuck like that?
Yeah.
He tries to straighten the fingers on his right hand, but his ring finger stays bent.
It's locked, my fingers. Yeah, it doesn't work.
Through an interpreter, he says this happened from making the same repetitive motion day after day.
But now it's a little bit better because he changed another job.
JBS has temporarily reassigned Basar to assembling boxes, and he's scheduled to meet with a hand specialist who will determine if he needs surgery. I sat down with Basar and four of his co-workers to talk about their jobs. They too are refugees from Burma and Malaysia. Using an interpreter, Mohammed Noor says the risk of injury depends on the work you're doing.
For heavy things lifting up, then people got back pain. If it is a knife-using job, then people got finger problem.
Mohammed Shakir has not yet started his job at JBS. After hearing the stories that the other men share, including one who's been there for 9 years, He told me this isn't his ideal job.
Yeah, so he has to go to JBS because it is the easier one to get a job for non-English speaker.
While they're critical of the work, all agree that JBS is still their best option. And research suggests, compared to U.S.-born employees, refugees are more likely to stay at this job longer. Basar is just thankful to be in the U.S. and says he loves Greeley.
I have a country right now. I don't have any problem here. Just working. So I'm good feeling. My feeling is right now is very, very good.
But he had no idea the work would be this difficult. The day after visiting him at his apartment, I meet Basar and our interpreter at a doctor's office in Greeley.
I want to check into my finger.
I wasn't allowed to go in with him to see the specialist, but after 20 minutes, Basar returns with good news.
Doctor says it's okay.
Physical therapy and the break from his job on the processing line have helped. Again, here's his interpreter.
It looks much better than before, so no need to have a surgery.
Basar is visibly relieved. We say our goodbyes, and he goes home to get ready for his 3 p.m. shift at the JBS plant. I'm Esther Honig in Greeley. All right, we have more insightful and inspiring stories to get to, including a glimpse at what it's like for students needing to overcome language and cultural barriers before they even set foot in the classroom. And just a quick note here, you'll find more from our series, Resettled, The Lives of Refugees, including photos and video, at refugee.kunc.org.
Work in the meatpacking industry may be one of the most common jobs for refugees relocating to Colorado. But even for those who get their start there, it doesn't mean that's where they have to stay. KUNC's Stacey Nick has the story of one man's path to a different career.
For Abdulwahab Haid, running a business is something that's just in his blood. He took over his father's restaurant in Somalia at the age of 17.
Back home, I have my own business. And I get in more benefit, like when you work somebody or you work on your own.
After coming to the United States in 2007, Haid, like many others in the area, worked at the local meatpacking plant.
I see Cargill was very hard.
But he had dreams of doing something different. So 5 years ago, he opened the Fort Morgan Mini Halal Market in a shopping center close to much of the town's East African and Middle Eastern immigrant population. There's no sign on the outside of the building. Inside, Haid shows me the items specifically curated for his customers.
All these perfumes, they cannot get other stores. I have my own perfumes. And oils, they don't find it.
At first, the idea of leaving a stable job at Cargill and taking the risk of opening a business seemed daunting. He thought he'd need hundreds of thousands of dollars to start even a small business in America. But he also saw an opportunity.
For Morgan, they don't have any business at that time. And I see they need to get a business in my community.
I expect as we get programming going that we'll see more pins in West Africa. We have quite a few in East Africa.
Inside the One Morgan County office, Executive Director Susana Guardado stands in front of a world map with clusters of pushpins in it. Whenever someone comes in, she first gets out a pin and asks them to mark their family roots.
Something that's always been ingrained for me since I was little is whenever I would hear any negative rhetoric towards immigrants, I knew enough history to know, wait, we're all coming from immigrant backgrounds, unless you're a Native American here.
Guardado immigrated to Fort Morgan from Zacatecas, Mexico, when she was 5 years old. Her father came here to work at Cargill, which he still does. Now, she helps immigrants connect with their new community.
I'd like to get help translating my transcript, or I had this career in this country. What can I do here? And trying to find pathways for people.
Abdulwahab Haid already knew a lot about running a business in Somalia. What he needed was help navigating the process of opening a store here. He started small, really small.
At that time, I have a 7,500.
7,500 to start a store?
Yeah, and I pay rent, and I pay deposit for rent, and I start just stuff of grocery store.
In the beginning, he only stocked staple items: cornmeal, beans, rice, and halal meat, which is slaughtered in keeping with Islamic law.
All the other stores like Walmart or Safeway or Walgreens, they didn't sell goat meat. And I focused it to my community wanted.
There are also products familiar to most Americans sprinkled throughout the aisles, like Coca-Cola, ramen noodles, and flour tortillas. Over the years, he's also learned what doesn't sell well, like fresh camel milk and meat.
But right now, I didn't sell it because of it is very expensive, and the community, they don't buy it.
He does keep some powdered camel milk on hand for those who really want it.
Some of them, they like Lipton, but all this was... It's like back home.
The pride he has in his business is on full display when he shows me a wall of tea at the back of the store.
Yeah. How is that pronounced? Kitepa?
Kitapa. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a tea bag. It was like Kenya tea. It's from Kenya.
And if someone comes into the store who's a little low on cash...
If they don't have money, I can give them and they pay me back.
It's that kind of service and attention that makes the Fort Morgan Mini Halal Market stand out. Because for Haid, the store is more than just a place to pick up a few things for dinner. It's a community service. Stacy Nick, KUNC, Fort Morgan.
This feels like a good time to define what is meant when we talk about who is a refugee. Based on international law, the U.S. defines refugee as a person outside the country of his or her nationality who's unable or unwilling to return to that country because of persecution or a fear of persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion.
The number of refugees accepted to the United States each year is set by the president in consultation with Congress. The Trump administration has cut the number of refugees that can settle in the U.S., citing security concerns and a desire that they settle closer to their home countries. Last year, 981 refugees came to Colorado, far below the number in past years.
Colorado's refugee resettlement coordinator, Kit Tainer, says the change has created a degree of sadness among those hoping to bring their families here.
There's a lot of refugees who live and reside in Colorado and call it home, who have been waiting for the opportunity to rejoin with family members who are still overseas.
Not only are they waiting for the opportunity to rejoin with family, but some are also waiting for the opportunity to work the same jobs they had in their home country. Many highly skilled refugees resettling here end up in jobs in the food and beverage or hospitality industries. It can be especially difficult for medical professionals who need a license to continue their careers in the U.S. As KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, despite efforts from the state, they're running into obstacles.
The inside of Ines Al-Shiraz's office is small but tidy. There's a coffee mug on her desk with a photo of her smiling kids on it.
This is my daughter, Abby. She's now 11 and she's in the fifth grade. And this is my son, Haider. He's a first grader.
Al-Shiraz is a health navigator for a refugee medical clinic in Aurora. She schedules appointments and does interpreting for the newly resettled. She likes her job, but it's a far cry from her time as a practicing dentist in Baghdad, Iraq.
I thought that I achieved all I wanted. I owned a house in the mountains. I was driving a 2014 car in 2014. I didn't want to leave.
But safety concerns that year forced her to drop everything and flee. And when she arrived in Denver, she couldn't find work.
I don't know where to look. I know nobody here. I have friends, but they are in other states. I just felt it's just out of the system. An outsider. I don't know how to explain it better. It's just I felt an outsider.
Each year, dozens of doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals like Al-Shiraz come to Colorado only to realize their foreign certifications aren't worth much in the U.S.
It's what's referred to as the brain waste.
Carrie Miller is with Colorado Welcome Back. It's a nonprofit that helps guide refugees through job interviews and other hurdles of getting back into their professions. She's working with more than 100 clients right now.
You see a lot of people, they're working in entry-level jobs, working, you know, they're driving Uber, they're working, you know, in production, they're working as cashiers. They're underemployed. They're far underemployed.
Colorado's Department of Human Services found the issue costs the state's economy more than $8 million annually. Miller says most can't juggle the stress of adapting to a new country while chasing a career in a highly competitive field.
And so undervaluing where people came from. And I'm not saying that there's not differences. Like, you have to address that, but there needs to be a system in place where we're at least acknowledging some common standard, global standards.
The state's Refugee Resettlement Office is responding to the issue by investing in more retraining programs, and not just for medical professionals. Kit Tainer is the office's director.
We want to instill that in our refugee community members, that what they're doing when they first arrive doesn't necessarily have to be what they're doing in 5 years and in 10 years and in 15 years.
Tainer says they're looking to bridge the gap by offering scholarships for those looking to get back into high-skilled fields.
Whether that is a maintenance program or whether that is transcript evaluation for your transcripts overseas to allow you to continue education here can be quite expensive. If you're working a lower wage job, investing money in that versus investing money in rent is a really hard decision for refugee families to make.
And one that Enes Al-Shara, the Iraqi dentist, has been grappling with. The recertification program she's looking at costs upwards of $200,000.
The idea of a debt coming as a refugee coming from back home is really scary. We don't have this system of being in debt or paying off homes. It's like we just live on what we have.
But it's not the only obstacle. The years spent resettling and not treating patients have left her skills a bit rusty, and that makes passing exams tricky.
It's just like a driving. If you don't drive for a while, you find it kind of weird to get into the car and drive. I don't know if you have ever experienced this, but I did.
She's tried and failed for 2 years in a row to get into the dental program at the University of Colorado. And until recently, Al-Shara's been hesitant to expand her options outside the state.
I'm looking for a home. And I've been calling Colorado my second home, and I didn't want to move. It brings the trauma of leaving my home again.
But this year, she's applied to several schools in other states.
The dream is to get back to me. That is who I am. That's how much I have invested time, money, my parents' investment, support, family support, many years of my life to get to that point. And it's not a new dream, it's just getting back to who I am.
And she's eager to get an acceptance letter this spring. Matt Bloom, KUNC, Aurora.
So far in this episode, we have focused strictly on adults. But what about teenagers going to high school? That's tough enough for American students.
Indeed.
But what if you had to also overcome language and other cultural barriers? KUNC's Stephanie Daniel profiles three students from the same family who are making this adjustment together.
Abdul Ghani bin Abdul Munaf, or Ghani as he goes by, is 18 and a Rohingya Muslim. His parents, who are originally from Burma, also known as Myanmar, immigrated to Malaysia before he was born.
The school is really big, and I was really nervous. Like, I'm a first time. Nobody know me, who I am, and where I come from.
Because of racism against Muslims, he says he couldn't go to school or work. With two brothers already living in Greeley, Ghani, along with his mother, sister, three other brothers, and a niece, arrived here in late 2017.
My mom said, I got opportunity to take you all, go to America. They're going to give you opportunity to go to the school and learn something, be something.
Last year, Ghani was one of about 370 English language learners at Greeley Central High School.
The most important thing that I have to do is learn English to speak. Because if I don't know how to speak English, so it's going to be tough for me wherever I go.
Some students have had a strong academic background from their native country, and others, they were not able to do all years of school prior to coming to high school.
Laura DeGroat is a culturally and linguistically diverse, or CLD, teacher who co-teaches math. 2 decades ago, she says there were probably 20 EL learners at Central. Last year, they made up almost a quarter of the student body.
Predominantly, my students when I first started here were Spanish speakers, mostly from Mexico. And over the past decade, the population has diversified greatly with incoming refugees from different countries, and then a lot of students from Central America.
When I get here, I can't believe it. I was so happy, and I can't go to school.
17-year-old Rohayati binti Rafiq is Ghani's niece. In Malaysia, she stayed home and cooked and helped with her younger siblings. But here, Rohayati is just a teenager having fun with her friends.
My friend is the best. They help me. They help me with my homework, and we make some fun and we go outside.
Are most of your friends, are they most of them Muslim?
Yeah, Muslim.
Yeah.
But also a different country. They are Muslim, yeah.
What countries are they from?
Somali and Rohingya.
Most of Rohayati's friends wear hijabs. They cover their head with scarves. But during my visit to Central, she was the only one I saw wearing a niqab or face veil.
Not a lot of girls would do that. Like, I tell her, like, you were very brave.
Fatia Bakardlay is also a CLD teacher and a Somali Muslim. She grew up in Ethiopia before resettling in Minnesota at 14. Now 27 and a graduate of the University of Northern Colorado, she became a teacher to work with newcomers.
I see a lot of diversity in our schools, among students specifically, but I don't see a lot of diversity among staff. And I want to show our students that, hey, there is one of you in staff and you can aim more like that or higher or become a scientist or someone.
So 4 times 2 is what?
8.
That's Abdul Karim bin Abdul Munaf. He's Ghani's older brother and Rohayati's uncle.
My entire family, no one graduate from school or college. So I'll be the first one.
And Laura Duke Rote has been with him since the beginning.
I guess I could use the word deficit. So he didn't have some things like basic skills that we learn in primary, like multiplication, division. But he picked up those quickly, and he's tackling grade level work now.
Karim graduated from an Islamic school in Malaysia, but he studied religion, not academics.
Okay, and if I keep doing that, what's 8 times 2?
16.
16, good.
So now he's trying to get his diploma before he turns 21 next January and ages out of high school.
I want to graduate so badly because just want to make my family's life better and make them proud of me.
And like other students, Karim is thinking about life after school. He says he wants to go to college and study information technology. As for Rohayati and Ghani, they're busy being teenagers.
I can go to school, have friends.
Make a life. That's all.
Stephanie Daniel, KUNC.
One interesting thing that didn't quite make it into the stories here is that many refugees, after they've resettled here, take on a new birthday, January 1st. Colorado's Refugee Resettlement Coordinator Kit Tainer explained.
Oftentimes, refugees are unclear around when their birthdays are, simply because potentially there's not the same allegiance to the calendar like there is in the United States and their home countries. So oftentimes they use UNHCR, so the United Nations for High Commission for Refugees, uses January 1st as the birth date when the birth date is unknown. January 1st is a huge birthday celebration within the refugee community because so many refugees have that birthday. So we use it as a time to celebrate the refugee experience and sort of that transition from being overseas in an environment in which that wasn't necessarily the most important thing to being, you know, kind of over here when our birthdays are something that we know and we live by.
And on that note, if you have questions, suggestions, or feedback on this series, we'd love to hear it. You can comment on any of the stories at refugee.kunc.org.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. If you're not a member, please know that you can support our work with a contribution in any amount at kunc.org. Our show this week was produced by me, Aaron O'Toole.
And me, Ryan Larson. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with digital editor Jackie High.
And thanks to digital manager Ashley Jeffcoat, who created the website for all the stories in our Resettled series.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kala Tana. Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions.
If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. A great way to do that is to subscribe at KUNC.org, or you can do that wherever you get your podcasts.
And make sure to join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.